Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we discuss the life and legacy of Shalom Asch. Born in Poland to an Orthodox Jewish family, Asch was a novelist, playwright, and essayist acclaimed by both critics and readers alike. He was one of the first Yiddish writers to attract a wide readership in translation and one of the best-known Jewish public figures of his time, a global icon. Asch became a U.S. citizen in 1920. His writings included bestsellers in English translation, such as his Christological trilogy, The Nazarene, The Apostle, and Mary. He was also a prominent figure in theater with smash hits on the Yiddish stages of Warsaw and New York. His writings were provocative and often courted controversy. His 1907 play, God of Vengeance, resulted in a famed obscenity trial and has inspired many adaptations and reworkings, including Paulo Vogel's 2015 hit, Indecent. For this episode, we are joined by two writers with close ties to Asch. David Mazower is the editorial director at the Yiddish Book Center and chief curator and writer of their permanent exhibit, Yiddish, A Global Culture. He is the great-grandson of Shalom Asch. Carrot O'Brien is a translator and playwright who has translated 8 of Asch's plays into modern English. You can learn more about our guests and their work in the episode description. David and Carrot are interviewed by Nate King, content and exhibits manager at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place March 2nd, 2026, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you, Carrot and David, for joining me today on this episode of Nation of Writers. I'm excited to speak with you and learn more about Shalom Asch, who is one of the featured writers in our current special exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture. But before we get too much into that, could you introduce yourself to our listeners a little bit and maybe tell us how you first got introduced to Shalom Asch and his work? And David, we could start with you, perhaps.
Yes, sure. And hi, thanks so much for inviting me and to do this podcast. And it's just wonderful to be on with Carrot, who's a friend and collaborator and a dear colleague and a wonderful advocate for Shalom Asch and so much else. So really great to be here. Thank you. So yeah, Shalom Asch is my great-grandfather. So it's simple, but it's also complicated, I guess, in a way. In ways we'll get into. I guess the first thing to say is that I didn't know him. He died a few years before I was born. He died in 1957 on a visit to my grandmother, actually, in London. He had just moved to Israel for what turned out to be just the final 18 months or so of his life. He was visiting my grandmother, died, was buried in London. And so, yeah, I never knew him, but I grew up very much within his aura, I would say. And that was kind of initially just sort of sensory and tactile, because my grandmother's apartment was just like a sort of house museum or a flat museum to her father, really, to her parents. And so much of what she had by way of books and paintings and busts of him and so many other things, Judaica, some of what you now exhibit, you have in the museum, is just part of what was, I grew up with seeing in my grandmother's apartment. And so I just sort of, before I can even think of my earliest memories almost, I was just fascinated by all this stuff. And it was just so beautiful. And there were portraits of him and, books dedicated to him, as I later discovered on the bookshelves. And so, yeah, that was my introduction, really, was through that, those early childhood years of going every week, as we would do for lunch, to my grandparents.
Wow, I love that. Thank you. It's fascinating. Yeah, it's like you said, the sort of items we have on display in the exhibit were just living among. Yeah, that's, how do you not absorb a little bit of that through osmosis?
Yeah, and as I was polishing them before you picked them up for the exhibition, I was thinking, I remember my grandmother polishing those and other pieces, and presumably, it would have been her mother, I'm sure, before her, Shalom Asch's wife and partner, who did that. So, it was kind of an emotional experience just getting them ready for you to put in the case.
Wow, fascinating. I definitely want to talk about them, but maybe we'll hold off on that for a little bit. Carrot, could you tell us a little bit about, because I picked up the items from your apartment in New York City, so you're connected to them as well.
Yes, I'm delighted to be connected with them. I loved hearing David's story of growing up in the Shalamash Museum. Even just having those few objects in my house, which I had displayed on my table all week, was pretty thrilling for me. You know, they kind of hummed with his energy. So I like that you described that you were raised in Shalamash's aura, even though that he died before you were born. I'm from an Irish family and an Irish-speaking family, and I came to Yiddish in translation. And the first Yiddish writer that really moved me was Chaim Grada, the novelist. And then, so I decided to major in university in Yiddish, and I took this incredible Yiddish theater class with Ruth Weiss, where we read the classics of Yiddish drama in Yiddish. And one of those plays that we read was Sholomash's play, God of Vengeance. And I was just blown away by this play that was written in 1906, and it had a lesbian love scene, and it was about religious hypocrisy. And I grew up attending only Catholic schools, and there was a lot of religious hypocrisy in the aura that I was seeped in. So I just became fascinated by this play, and I saw a version of it shortly after I moved to New York to become an actor, because what are you going to do with a Yiddish theater degree or a Yiddish literature degree? And I saw a play that was just, it was, you know, I felt almost like the ghost of Shalamash rising from the floorboards and looking at me and saying, you know, this is not the play that I wrote. And I started complaining about it to a colleague, and who said, listen, please stop complaining about it and just translate your own version of it. And so I did, and we opened it up at Show World, the world famous strip club in Times Square, which was the perfect place for it because it was about a Jewish brothel owner and his attempts to become legitimate and have a Torah scroll written. So it was really seeped in the sacred and profane. And I went on to translate a bunch of his other plays as well.
And that production, which, as you know, Carrot, I saw,
Yes, I remember.
it was just shattering in the best possible way, brilliant and so eye-opening. And I remembered it so well. It was this low-ceilinged rectangular room mirrored all the way around with, a couple of platforms, I think. And it was just, as you say, just unbelievably beshert, as we say in Yiddish, fated, meant to be, that, there it was. Through this warren, this labyrinth of rooms and passages in Show World, and it was breathtaking.
Thank you. Thank you. I remember meeting you there as well. And you know, we there was a the stripper pole was in the middle of the stage that we all performed around it, and it was very dark. The energy was very dark.
Fascinating. There's a lot of ways that I want to branch off, but maybe for a little bit we could talk about the sort of breadth of Shalamash's work. Because, Karen, you've mentioned the playwriting and his prominence in Yiddish theater history, but then and then there's also his novels and essay writing. So maybe now's a good time for us to kind of take a look for our listeners as well at Shalamash's sort of brief bio and the avenues in which he was renowned as a writer.
Sure. It's really hard to sum him up and sum up his work, but I guess, I mean, I'll try. So, and I didn't say earlier that I now work at the Yiddish Book Center, so I kind of work professionally like Carrot in the Yiddish world. And it's just wonderful to be sort of learning more and more about my great grandfather through my work over the last 8 years at the Yiddish Book Center, and having engaged with his work and writing about it for a bit longer than that. But there is so much more to learn. I really feel like I'm just sort of glimmer, at the beginning, getting these glimmers of understanding of the measure of his career as a not just a writer. He was also a public figure, and maybe we can get into that. He was extremely active as a public figure and a public intellectual. But just to sum up, his literary career, I would say, to simplify it, you could think of it in three parts. He was born in 1880 in Kutna, a small town in the middle of Poland. It's about an hour from Warsaw, into a very religious family. There would have been absolutely no secular literature in the home, I'm pretty sure of that. He had an entirely religious education as a kid. And in his own telling, chafed against that. He found that frustrating. He always had a sense of sort of the wider world and broader horizons out there, and he was just desperate to access that. And so long story about his teenage years, but fundamentally, he makes his way to Warsaw in 1899 as a 19-year-old to be a Yiddish writer. And that is not a model that exists really in the Jewish world at that time. There are almost no professional writers in Yiddish or Hebrew. There are great writers, but they almost all write, in their spare time and hold other jobs that pay the rent. And that changes with Ash, but it changes through tremendous effort and tremendous sort of force of will. So he starts out in 1899, 1900 as a short story writer. Actually, his first stories were in Hebrew. And then, under the influence of his mentor, a guy called Peretz, I.L. Peretz, who ran a literary salon in Warsaw, he switches to Yiddish, but still writing short stories and sketches. And then, with the play that Kara just mentioned, God of Vengeance and others, that wasn't his first play, but it was his first big hit in 1907. He mainly is a playwright, I would say, in the second half of the 1900s into the 1910s. And then by the 1920s, he pretty much leaves the theatre behind and is almost entirely a novelist and a journalist. So that's a sort of grotesque simplification, but it's kind of fundamentally true in essence. And as I say, throughout his life, from really the 1900s through to the end of his life in 1957, whether in Poland or in France or in America or the end of his life in Israel, he's also, as I say, this public figure weighing in on debates, on politics, on anti-Semitism in Poland and Germany, and very, very much else besides.
And just to give an example of something that I really love about Sholomash outside of his writing, like for instance, during World War I, he was in America at the time, but he knew it was happening in Europe, and he traveled across America two times as part of a group of people trying to raise $1 billion to support the communities that were being decimated during the war. And so he did more than anybody to in America to help rebuild those communities. He's one of the first reporters to go over there after the war. He smuggled money on his person to distribute, and he worked with the New York Times in describing what he saw on the incredible devastation and poverty and hunger that the Jewish communities were dealing with. And it was so traumatizing for him that he had a nervous collapse when he came back, and then he kind of wrote himself out of that by writing his anti-war drama, The Dead Man, which is a really powerful play, I think, about the veil between the living and the dead that he set in the Jewish communities after World War I during the flu epidemic, when it was hard to tell who was living and who was dead. And you can listen to it actually on the website of the Yiddish Book Center. I translated it and recorded it a couple of years ago.
Thank you for that. Yes, I'm glad you mentioned the Yiddish Book Center because that is a great resource. I definitely recommend our listeners check it out. There's a lot online, then also in person. A great organization, and you do great work.
Yeah, and what I wanted to dive into saying, what's so special about this moment in Sholomash fandom is that he has a prominent place in the incredible exhibit that David curated at the Yiddish Book Center called Yiddish, a Global Culture, and also a prominent place in the American Prophets exhibit. And having being the person who has seen both of those exhibits, there's a lot of simpatico feeling, and they're both very inspiring in terms of the breadth of the creativity that both of you depict in these really just stunning exhibits.
Thank you. And I haven't seen Yiddish, a Global Culture yet in person, but
You can get the catalog as well, which is also beautiful and full of incredible images from the exhibition.
we'll have links in the episode description as well for the listeners to check out. Maybe now's a good time to talk about Yiddish, kind of maybe generally, but also Ash's use of it or his choice to write in it. Like you mentioned, David, his first stories were in Hebrew. But then, as I recall, there was perhaps one of his mentors sort of encouraged him to write in Yiddish.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's important to understand that, at the time that Ash was thinking about being a writer and starting to dream about his future outside of the religious world that he was sort of destined for, Yiddish was not seen as a suitable vehicle for sort of high status literature. Almost all the aspiring Jewish writers of Central and Eastern Europe were writing either in Hebrew or the sort of majority language around them, whether that was Russian or Polish or German or something else. And it was only really from the middle of the 19th century, quite slowly, and then increasing as the sort of later 19th century went on, that it sort of the possibility of writing in Yiddish was even a thing. And why was it a thing? Because that was what the masses, the Jewish readership in the region, spoke and read. And so everybody knew that if you wanted to reach a mass audience in, the Jewish communities of the Ashkenazi world in Central and Eastern Europe, the only way to do it was to write in Yiddish. I mean, if you were an assimilated German Jewish writer, it was different. You didn't have the choice. You didn't know Yiddish, probably. But for those who were bilingual and trilingual and much more lingual, because it was very common, for writers of Asher's generation to read and write and be conversant in four or five languages, that was in no way unusual. So they are extremely sophisticated in their intellectual horizons. But the choice to write in Yiddish kind of was not easy for many of them. It involved this sort of psychological struggle. Am I really going to write in the language of the maidservants and the market women and the peddlers and the wagon drivers? It just seemed impossible somehow and ridiculous. But that's what they do. And so Ash is really in the forefront of creating this new literature in a language that's 1,000 years old. So Yiddish goes back to Western Europe and Central Europe of the 11th century onwards. And it's written in Hebrew letters and Hebrew characters. It uses the Hebrew alphabet, but it is, in essence, a Germanic-based language with a lot of Slavic words and considerable amount of Hebrew and other things. So it's a very sort of supple, pliant language. It has this extraordinary kind of bedrock of sort of folk wisdom and folk sayings, and it's extremely kind of piquant. But it's in every way a language that can be used, for high literature, just as any other language can. And yeah, so Ash is distinctive in being amongst that first generation to switch into Yiddish from another language. In his case, it was easy because he was fluent in it. There are many other Yiddish writers who made that deliberate choice, who actually had to work at their Yiddish, but for, emotional or political reasons, desperately wanted to write in Yiddish.
Thank you. That's fascinating. It's interesting because it's at the time when Osh was returning to Yiddish, was there sort of like a social or cultural stigma attached to writing in Yiddish, would you say?
Yeah, definitely both of those things, a social and a cultural stigma. And it was sort of ridiculed openly by many Jewish intellectuals, this whole idea of a Yiddish literature. And Yiddish was in many ways primarily a language of sort of popular culture and popular fiction before it was a language of high literary art. And it remained a language of sort of dime novels and pulp fiction throughout, but then grew into this sort of literary form. I mean, I guess the other thing I should say in Ash's case is that he wasn't a great linguist. I mean, he could read and speak in English and French and German and Polish, but probably the only languages he was really fluent in were Hebrew and Yiddish, I would say. So it was kind of an easy choice, easier for him in many ways than for some other writers.
Interesting.
And I'd also just like to dive in to say that pretty early in the development of Yiddish literature of the modern era, let's say at the end of the 1800s, there was Yiddish writers were translating world classics into Yiddish so that their audiences who didn't speak Polish or Russian or English could understand the breadth of world literature. And Asch was obviously a voracious reader, and I'm not sure what language he read some of the classics in, but he certainly had way beyond a reference point literatures other than Yiddish. His first full-length play On the Road to Zion was a verse response to Chekhov's The Seagull, and he was actually mentored by this great Russian actress and director Vera Komissarzhevskaya, who was the original Nina in The Seagull. So he was responding to Chekhov with that first play, and his second play, his most famous play, God of Vengeance, he wrote that after he went to the most experimental theater in the world at the time, which was Max Reinhardt's theater in Berlin. And they had Rudolf Schildkraut playing Shylock. And he was so moved by this Jewish anti-hero that he wanted to create an equally corrupt and difficult anti-hero for his next play, which he did with Yanko Shapshovich in The Brothel Owner and God of Vengeance, who is just trying to be accepted into the community that he finds himself in.
Yeah, it's a great point. And that play, that production, which I think opens in March 1907 in Berlin at this Temple of Modernism, the Deutsches Theater. I mean, there is, you cannot get better and higher than that as a dramatist. And so this was just the most sensational event in Yiddish literature, and a deep cause of jealousy and envy for many of Asch's fellow writers. How on earth has he pulled this off? He's 26. He goes to the world's greatest modernist theater and somehow persuades them all they're going to translate and put on this totally unknown Yiddish play by a totally unknown, I mean, a writer who's unknown outside the Yiddish world, let's say. And it was a sensation. It was an extraordinary thing, and it speaks to his determination, his charisma, his sort of unbreakable sense of the prize in front of him. He was not going to be stopped. And there's a sort of more complex story around the Reinhardt Circle, several of whom are from Galicia and are Yiddish-speaking intellectuals who've now sort of cemented their place in Berlin and in sort of German-speaking centers, Berlin and Vienna. But they are sympathetic, or at least they understand Asch's world because it's also their world. It's where they came out of. So it's very interesting to actually look at the people who were, the dramaturg and some of the people who Reinhardt was working with, and indeed Reinhardt himself. But still, it was a remarkable event.
And he seemed to have been fearless about crashing through cultures and getting the mentorship that he needed. I mean, he had a traditional Jewish education or Talmudic studies and all the rest. And then he taught himself German through a German translation of the Psalms. And then, as a very young man, he left to Warsaw and started attending the cafes or going where the artists were and was mentored by several Polish Christian artists who, introduced him to other people. And this became, he writes in his memoirs that the shtetl that he grew up in, or the town that he grew up in, the Jewish members of the town were more successful than the Christian members. So at first he felt bad for the Christians, considering that, they didn't believe in the Jewish God, so that they were having a harder time in life. And he, I always think of him as an interfaith pioneer, because in his novel writing career, he wrote in the late 30s and 40s, he wrote novels about the Jewishness of Jesus, Mary, and Paul the Apostle. And this got him huge acclaim in Christian audiences in many languages around the world. But it also caused him to be rejected by the Yiddish-speaking community, who would no longer hire him because it was during World War II, and they felt that this was a betrayal of some sort by Asch. But he was always, it's like the humanity and the in all peoples and all religions was something that he was always pointing toward and searching for and believing in. And he was also such a very, in my mind, very much a socialist writer. His play and his novel Matka Ganov, Matka the Thief, is a psychological portrait of a criminal. It's this abused street kid who joins the circus and becomes a pimp because that's the only way he can lift himself out of poverty. His novel and movie Uncle Moses is about a corrupt sweatshop boss, So he's writing about these, his characters have incredible ambition. They want to make their way in the world. They want to be respectable. They want to have enough money to rise up out of poverty. And he creates these psychological portraits of them where you have so much empathy for the compromises and darknesses that they're willing to go through to better their circumstances.
Yeah, wow. Well said. It kind of answers another question. It leads me to that sort of through lines in his work of his various, if we can very rudimentarily break up his career into three parts, right? Like, what's the through line between those three parts? I think you kind of mentioned it there, Carrot. And when you mentioned the sort of interfaith approach to his work also was one of the aspects that I, in my research for American Prophets, pulled out. He was one of the writers that seemed to be searching, like you said, for the humanity that is inherent in all the religions, the more looking at the similarities rather than the differences between a certain faith system. So yeah, I'm just, are there any other sort of through lines or sort of major themes do you think he was attempting to tackle in his work?
I mean, I think Herod has identified, one of the key things for which he became known, which is, his attempts to bridge Judaism and Christianity. I mean, though, he grew up in a country that always had a level of anti-Semitism, sometimes sort of explosive and violent, other times just sort of simmering under the surface. I don't think it was a big feature of his childhood particularly, but in some ways, Poland in the 20th century is a much darker and more violent place, even before the First World War, than Poland in the 19th century. So there's a sort of growing sense of nationalism. There's an economic boycott and institutional boycotts of Jews from the through the 1930s and even a bit earlier. So all of that, he was steeped in and observing and writing about, not just in his fiction but also in his nonfiction. I would add to that at least two things. One is that he was always known as a very lyrical writer, a sort of writer who depicted nature and was sort of at one with nature and celebrated nature in his writing, going back to another of his breakthrough works, The Shtetl, The Little Town, The Small Town. And that's a very sort of it's a very romantically imbued portrait of we don't exactly know where, but a Polish town anyway, of the sort that he grew up in. And in many other works, there are these really cinematic descriptions of nature, and that was something he was known for. And the second thing I would add is that he was known very early as a writer who had great psychological insight into his female characters, into the way he wrote girls and women, and especially girls and young women. And so in God of Vengeance, there's the teenage daughter who is the in a way, the sort of focal point of the play, the darling of her parents' eye, the one who must be protected from the brothel downstairs, who has to be kept pure and virtuous and make this respectable match that will lift her parents out of their situation, and she is given real depth and her own feelings and desires and her sort of awareness of the hypocrisy of the situation that her parents have put her in is a real theme and running through the play. But then there's also the mother, who was a former madam herself in a brothel, now married to the brothel owner, and she has sort of elements of Lady Macbeth. She's very strategic and very and the one who's sort of bringing her husband back from the brink when he's losing it, and his world is falling apart, and he's raging against God. How has his world come crashing down on him like this? And Sura, the wife, is the one pulling it together and pulling him together, out of desperation, really, but also desperation to save her daughter's name and reputation. So she is also this really, multi-sided character. She's given real complexity by Ash, and he does that throughout his writing, and he was really beloved by his female readership for that, and it's very explicit in a lot of the memoirs that you read, where people recall the books they were reading and why were they reading them in the 1900s and 1910s, and that is often a theme.
And I would also say that there's more than a bit of the theologian in him. He was an anti-poverty activist. I mean, he spoke about it in his lectures to Columbia, that not only that it was our responsibility to make sure that everyone was fed and had enough work that was well paid, that was a failure, an artificial failure of society that we all needed to stand out against. And he was very much spoke out against a religious hypocrisy. There was good rabbis and bad rabbis in his plays, and brothel owners with purer intent than somebody who was pretending to be religious, but was only just manipulating people or trying to move things in their own favor. So he talks a lot about also in his memoir how moved he was by his father's true goodness. He was a very religious man, but he was also a truly good men who gave money equally to Jewish and Christian people in need. And you get that sense in his works that there is a type of person with a deep character who's interested in doing the right thing, even though it might not seem like the right thing to, a prim and proper society, judging them. And that really, I really admired that, his sort of, you can feel his moral belief system and his moral authority and how he hopes that people will act, though he's very good at writing complicated characters with lights and shadows. He's not moralistic in any way, but it feels to me like what makes a good human being is a big part of his work.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, because I was thinking, another question I had was, what about his work makes it timeless, which I think it does. You saw the performance of his play. Again, I forget which one you saw, but that you felt him there, and I think maybe it's kind of the answer to that question is kind of what you both were saying, is he's talking about human nature, right? And the, hypocrisy inherent in human nature, and the settings and times, place, but that we're still humans, and there's yeah, something there that we're always trying to figure out, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, and there's another little detail that he has that actually some of my favorite Irish writers have is that he's setting them in a patriarchal religion in the history of Judaism, right? Or all his characters, or most of his characters are Jewish. But within there is this kind of, he has a lot of pagan rituals that often the women, but not always, some of the rabbis do. Like there's candle magic, there's spell casting, there's writing people's names on the bottom of bricks to try and get a certain outcome. So like the superstition in there, and the supernatural, which are things that he's able to weave into his works, that are you're just like you're uncovering secrets, or you're uncovering not just 5,000 years ago, but maybe transition traditions from that seeped in from 10,000 years ago. Just the kind of the ancestral chain of customs that he secrets away in his work.
Yeah, that's a great point, because of course, this was all around you in traditional Jewish Eastern Europe, this sort of shtetl mysticism and superstition and folklore and kind of folk magic, and it was everywhere, and it's absolutely true in his head. Actually, you just reminded me of one of my favorite quotes, which I'm struggling to remember, but the sense of it is it's from the writer Joseph Roth, the great German Jewish writer of the mid-century. So Ash was friends with Joseph Roth and Stefan Zweig, also two Jewish writers, much more assimilated, who wrote in German. And the three of them would meet up in Vienna occasionally. And there's wonderful correspondence. And the Joseph Roth's letters have been published in a really thick volume, and he wrote extraordinary letters. It was one of his kind of special skills. And he writes to Stefan Zweig at one point about Ash, and they've just met him, and he's sort of ruminating on this extraordinary character. And he says something like, Ash has this antique quality, like a sort of like he's stepped off Mount Olympus or something. And it's not quite that, but he portrays him as this really ancient figure of sort of prophetic wisdom. And he's not a great fan of Ash's writing, but he's clearly just finds his presence extraordinary, and his sort of charisma and his whole being, so other to someone like Roth, who is steeped in, intellectual assimilated Vienna and Berlin. That's his world. And here's Ash, who sort of stepped out of this traditional world of Jewish Eastern Europe, totally different kind of Jewish society, and somehow is at home in both those worlds. And it obviously, really makes Roth very curious, and he just has this wonderful turn of phrase in these letters.
Oh wow, I'm dying to see those letters now.
I'll
And
send it you.
thank you. And I had two mentors who actually knew Ash. They were actors, and they talked about his incredible charisma and power and elegance and dignity. People were once, he became super famous, people were, nervous around him. They wanted to please him or live up to his kind of regal standard. And yeah, so I think a lot about what it must have been like to have hung out with him. And I know from David that he was, you know, his life was full of incredible artists across disciplines and across languages. I mean, he clearly went deep with people all the time about art and life and what they were all trying to do. And all of that seeps into his writing.
That's certainly true. There are wonderful, wonderful accounts of him in so many different memoirs. He didn't write a lot of memoir and self-reflection himself. The few things he did are really interesting, but there's such a rich literature about him. He had this extraordinary status in the Jewish world. It's really hard to sort of picture it from our standpoint today, but really by about 1910, when he's just 30, and even a bit before, he was spoken of as the sort of great hope of modern Yiddish literature after the three kind of foundational figures, Mendel and Moshe Sporin, Sholem Aleichem, and Peretz, the guy we've mentioned as his mentor. And these are these three sort of titans of the 19th and early 20th century literature. And then everybody's thinking, who's going to come next? And Ash is the sort of heir apparent and often spoken about in that way in the 1910s and 1920s. And he was really seen as the key voice, the key representative of Polish Jewry abroad. Polish Jews looked to him in America, 1914 to 24, and then when he was in France, 1925 to 39, as, in many ways, the one person who would tell world Jewry and also world leaders to an extent and statesmen, about the suffering and the discrimination that Polish Jews were increasingly experiencing in the run-up to, and then, of course, with the rise of fascism in the 30s.
Yeah, he definitely had an element of the statesman about him. He was often called to give, you know, talks, and whenever he did give a talk, it was in the front page of the Forwards or whatever Jewish newspaper. And I was thinking about this, like he reminds me. I mean, this is a figure in Irish culture as well. Like when the poet Seamus Heaney died, it was like they were burying a king, you know. And Ash, for much of his career, had that level of admiration and public and policy influence that we don't see a lot of writers having today.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I'm trying to think of a sort of parallel in today's world, and I don't know if there is one where a literature base. There's plenty of celebrities, but I think that's quite different. His celebrity was different than the ones we think of now, perhaps. But
Yeah, I think it's a good point, but I think it was much more common, in Russian culture and, as Carrot says, in Irish culture, in some ways, than maybe in Anglophone culture. I mean, you think of someone like Tolstoy and his reputation, there are many others, but I can think of figures of that era more than I can think of contemporaries. I mean, someone like Salman Rushdie, maybe in a certain way, but perhaps reluctantly, but and others.
Toni Morrison, maybe.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good one. Yeah, it's fascinating. I mentioned David that he didn't do as much personal writing about himself, but he is mentioned in many other memoirs, which I think is fascinating. He had that much of an impact on other creatives' lives that they needed to include meeting him in their memoir.
And part of that was that he was just intensely kind of emotional as a character. There's so many stories of him, I don't know, breaking down crying, seeing a play that he liked, or he would go into a Warsaw branch of his bank, and while he was waiting to see the bank manager, time would pass, and he would just impulsively go up to a regular clerk at one of the desks and say, "I'm bored, let's arm wrestle." And so, 50 years later, this guy writes a story for the Yiddish press about, my afternoon arm wrestling with Sholem Ash. And there's just so many stories like that. He was just incredibly sort of changeable, quixotic, impulsive, had sort of tremendous highs, and also, and I think he knew this, could also be very vain and very egotistical and very childlike and capricious. We display it's also in the catalogue of the exhibition, but we have an exercise ball, one of these heavy leather, I think medicine ball we call it, in the exhibition. And this had an amazing story that I didn't know until I started putting this exhibition at the Yiddish Book Center together. and came across the daughter-in-law of a colleague of Ash's, a couple of writers actually, Peretz Hirschbein and Esther Shumiatsch. They're a husband and wife pair. He's primarily a playwright, story writer, also travel journalist, and she's primarily a poet. And they were good friends of my great grandparents. And at a certain point in the early 1940s, Hirschbein was suffering from the degenerative disease that ended up killing him a few years later. And so they needed to consult doctors on the East Coast. And at that point, they had a young son, their only child, who was then something like 7 years old, almost little boy. And Esther has this huge network of siblings, and so almost has a ton of aunts and uncles. And so when they go, they're living in Hollywood, they go east to New York. And so what are they going to do with their son for the week that they're consulting doctors? He's got to stay with somebody. So they say to him, almost, you want to stay with Bella? Do you want to stay with this one or that one? And he goes, no, I want to stay with Maja Ash, my great-grandmother. Because apparently he really loved my great grandmother. And so the Hirschbeins, bring up the ashes, I guess, and they say, how about it? Can we leave? Ashes were then living in Stamford, Connecticut. Can we leave almost with you for a week? Sure. So the boy spends a week there. He ends up playing with this ball with Sholomash, who has this exercise ball. Ash and Hirschbein both are very physical guys. They like walking, they like swimming, they like exercising, very proud of their physicality. So Ash and this 7-year-old kid are playing ball back and forth through the week, and time comes for his parents to pick him up, and he's made a deal, and he says, when my parents come, can I take the medicine ball with me? And Ash says, sure, of course, it's yours. It's now yours. And so the time comes, and they arrive, and he's like, okay, Sholem, where's the medicine ball? And he's like, I don't think so. It's actually, I really like it. It's my favorite ball. I'm going to buy you another one and send it. At which point his wife steps in and says, are you crazy? You promised him it's his. Go and get it and give it him. And so this 7-year-old boy takes the medicine ball away, and it sits on the Upper West Side, for 80 years and in storage. And now it's at the Yiddish Book Center, and you can see it in the catalog of the exhibition catalog. And I just love this story because it's so, it speaks to so many different parts of my great-grandfather's really complicated personality, and also my great-grandmother's personality as well. And she's the one who gets the final word, and a bit like the mother in God of Vengeance, Sura, she's the strong one and the one who kind of gets the last word.
Thank you for that. I love that story. And I also wanted to take a quick moment. We're getting close to the end here, but I did want to mention the items of Shalamash's that we have in the American Prophets exhibit at the American Writers Museum. I know we mentioned it kind of briefly in the beginning, but that there's especially one. So I guess I'll talk about them briefly. There's three spice boxes and two inkwells, both of antique. And the one especially I love the story of, I think you told me, Karen, the one inkwell that looks like a bird hatching from an egg is just a beautiful inkwell. But then you also mentioned there's a story that goes along with that, and it's in the very beginning of Land of My Soul, which your play that you gave me. And well, I'll let you tell the story, but it's just I've been telling that as folks have been as I've been touring the exhibit and telling them about the egg and why that the shape of a bird hatching from an egg is important.
Yeah, I was so thrilled when David showed me that amber inkwell that it's like a chick emerging from from an egg, because there's a famous inscription that Peretz, Ash's mentor, wrote on a book that he gave Ash, and it's he wrote it in Yiddish, but the translation is, "The egg is hatching, cracking open. Is it a crow or an eagle?" And eagle, of course, Nesher HaGadol, the great eagle, is a Jewish symbol. So it was so Ash then said that whenever he wrote anything, he thought to myself, "Is it a crow or an eagle? Am I going to write something imitative or just easily copied, or I'm going to write something that truly embodies the great eagle soul of his culture and his people?" And so that was so incredible to me that in David's private museum, he had the physical representation of this really deeply meaningful quote for Ash.
Yeah, and I love that you actually intuited that immediately, and I had never thought about that in relation to that particular object, even though I knew the quote, but I guess I hadn't really looked at it closely enough to really see that in it. And it makes perfect sense that, Ash would have treasured this throughout his life, and then it passed to my grandmother, and now I have it on, usually on display and at my place. And it is, and it speaks also to this wonderfully sort of elusive way that Peretz had of sort of speaking to his disciples, his proteges, the writers he would mentor, this very sort of open-ended mentorship, that he wasn't molding them into his own image, but he was questioning them, and he was pushing them to be the best version of themselves that they could be, which I think is just a great way of being a mentor of that sort, of any sort, really.
Can I tell you my three favorite Osh quotes?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Because you were asking that question, so of course I was thinking about it deeply. And the first one is from his play On the Road to Zion. This young Polish Jewish college student is uncertain about what he wants to do with his life, and he says, "A tiny piece of driftwood in the sea, that's what I am." And I think of that a lot. A tiny piece of driftwood in the sea, that's what I am. And Osh writing his way throughout Jewish history, because he often set things in, the Spanish Inquisition or in biblical times, as well as in the present day. And then in God of Vengeance, they're asking, like, is it going to go okay? They ask this religious scribe, is everything going to go okay to have this brothel owner, pay for this Torah scroll to be written? And the scribe, who was blind, which is the only way they would have gotten him in this situation, says, "Who can know? Our God is a God of mercy and compassion, but he is also a God of vengeance and retribution." And oh, that is so Osh. And that's the great foreshadowing that, everything is going to go haywire. Things can go well or things can go really, really bad. And then my last one is also from On the Road to Zion. This very kind of snotty, brilliant, young Polish university student who happens to be Jewish but doesn't care about Jewish culture at all, thinks it's kind of beneath her. She goes to visit this medieval castle that was a Polish Queen Esther who married a Polish king. It may or may not been an actual historical character, and she's transformed. She actually sees the castle come to life as how it must have looked like in the 14th century when it had a Jewish queen in it. And she says, describing the experience, she says, "My ears are still ringing with the sounds of the harp, the reverberating echo of her Yiddish melodies caught forever in the cracks of the castle. Ever since that moment when she, the Jewish tailor's daughter from Opoczno, sang for her lord and her lover, lulling him with her bosom and her black curly hair into a song of love and pleasure." And those quotes kind of encapsulate for me just the different styles that Osh would weave in. His characters sometimes would be super religious and quote almost Talmudic things, and sometimes they'd be incredibly poetic, and sometimes they'd be incredibly, just profound. And so he was, I think of him, I've done a lot of work on James Joyce as well, and I think of they're similar in the fact that they're both stylists, and they're always trying, Osh is always trying, seeing what other writers are doing it, and then making it his own. He's like Picasso that way. He'll, whatever he sees, he copied and did his version of it.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you for sharing those. Yes, I want to thank you both again for joining me. As we're getting close to wrapping up here, was there any other aspects of Osh's life or any other projects you have coming up that we haven't touched base on that you'd like to cover?
Probably so many, Nate.
I know, right? That's
I mean,
a tough question.
we could go. I think we've, hopefully given folks a reasonable introduction and maybe some curiosity to go and explore further. But I guess one thing that we didn't touch on that it's really important to understand about Ash is that he was the first Yiddish writer to really reach a world audience in translation. Initially, that's in Russian and German, but much later, and then this is, how he's known really in English. And so he's the first Yiddish writer to break through to a mass American readership fundamentally. And that's important, and it's also extremely influential in the careers of people like Isaac Bashevis Singer, a generation later, who really consciously And scholars have sort of traced this in Bathsheba Singer's life and work, models himself in many ways on Ash as an example of how you break through into kind of world status and world consciousness and get a world readership in English especially.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because I was I actually do want to, we're the American Writers Museum, and we've been talking about Szalmas and often, born in Poland, lived in Eastern Europe and France also, but also lived in the States. So I'm curious what his how would you characterize his relationship to the States, as well as sort of how did the he, like you said, he was the first one to kind of break Yiddish writer to break into an English reading audience. And so, like, what was his initial reception in the United States of America, as he was, immigrating, but then also residing here and moving to and from, just kind of following where the his stories were taking him, I guess. But yeah, how would you characterize his relationship with the States?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, he becomes an American citizen in 1920, and he is a passionate American in many ways in those early years. Really grateful to America for giving him and his family refuge just at the beginning of the First World War through this incredibly tumultuous, devastating time, and then into the 1920s, at which point he moves back to Europe, and then he comes back to America in 39, and again is deeply grateful for this sort of second period of refuge. But it's complicated because at the same time there's an ambivalence about America and about the possibilities for I guess Jewish really meaningful Jewish life in America. That's a big debate within in the Jewish world, Jewish continuity. Can you really carry on as a Jewish people without a Jewish language anchoring your society? So, American Jews very early on switch out of Yiddish into English. And so that's something that concerns him, and he thinks deeply about. And also, to an extent, the sort of materialism of America, its tremendous promise, its opportunity, but also some sense of a sort of shallowness at the core of the culture. He thinks and writes about these things a lot. So I guess he's a grateful American, but also an ambivalent American.
And he wrote a couple of his novels were set in America, like Uncle Moses and East River. And also in the 30s and 40s, he had about a dozen bestsellers in the, the whoever was the top best-selling books in English translation. So he was very well received here by English language audiences.
Yeah. Well, yes, thank you for that. And David, I think you're right. I hope this episode at least provides a spark of interest in reading more about Shalmash. I know in putting the exhibit together, I was, there's physical limitations, as you both know, in a physical exhibit. So I was, we had to cut certain aspects of his career and legacy. So that's why I'm glad that we were able to get you both on this episode together to talk more about it.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much. Really wonderful to have this opportunity, and great to talk with you both.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Nation of Writers, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you would like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., only closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.